You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about researchers who analyze social media posts about grief and stress to prevent violent crime among young people. And there's research that finds a pattern on social media posts. That is, young people post expressions of trauma and grief or stress before turning to more aggressive or threatening posts. So do you believe law enforcement should monitor social media to help prevent violence? Could it help stop violence? Have you ever been threatened on social media? What did that look like? We're at 800-642-1234. Desmond Patton is an associate professor of social work and sociology at Columbia University. He's founding director of a research initiative. It's called Safe Lab. It looks at ways in which youth of color navigate violence on and offline. Desmond, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with this online tool that you developed to detect aggression and grief in social media posts. How does it work?
So for the past 6 years, my colleagues and I have been working to develop a set of algorithmic systems that look at expressions of grief and loss, aggression, and substance use. What's different about our approach is that we are very clear on the fact that we don't understand the hyperlocal language, nuance, and culture in social media posts, and that when you misinterpret social media posts, you run the risk of criminalizing those individuals. And so what we do is that we hire young people from communities from which the data comes from, and we work with them to make sure that we understand the language, we understand the conversations, and we also consult with them around the ethics of developing these tools. And all of that input, those qualitative insights, go into developing this algorithmic tool that we have not yet deployed either, in part because we are concerned about the ways in which these tools may be used in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, so this is like a monitoring tool, made up on the back end by some algorithms. How can it understand the nuance that you would find in social media posts in a particular neighborhood?
So I would say that it's not a monitoring tool. What we're trying to do is to elucidate new patterns in social media data that have previously not been understood. So, for example, what social media and artificial intelligence allows us to do is to look at large amounts of social media data and to understand black box items that we previously may have misunderstood. For example, what we have found is that in our Chicago data set, expressions of grief and loss would come before more aggressive posts within about 2 days. And that was previously not discussed. We had typically thought that young people were using social media to kind of bolster arguments and to taunt one another, but actually they were leveraging it for help-seeking behaviors. And we understood that by being in conversation with young people, by privileging their voices, by understanding their needs, and by leveraging that those deep insights to make sure that when we are using a machine learning tool to understand the language, that those insights are embedded in the way in which the tool works.
Social media hasn't been around that long. Take us back to your early days of looking at this. Why did you decide to examine this relationship between what you're seeing on social media and violence?
You know, this all started from young people. I am a qualitative violence researcher and did my PhD in Chicago at the University of Chicago, and I was following a group of high-achieving African-American young boys. And they alerted me to things that were happening on Twitter. This is back in 2012, and they kind of identified a set of cases where young people were going back and forth, and that back and forth then led to violence offline. And so I went to the literature to learn more about it, and essentially there was nothing really there. And so in 2013, my colleagues and I from the University of Chicago sought out to really put some parameters and theory around this new phenomenon that at the time we called internet banging or cyber banging.
Yeah, what is that? Help us understand what internet cyber banging is, internet banging.
You know, it's a term that I'm in tension with right now, but initially it was a play on words, essentially trying to understand patterns of conversation and behavior in social media space that mimic the real world in terms of gang-like behavior. However, what I'm struggling now with the term is that it's too individually focused, and that these behaviors that we see on social media don't happen in the vacuum, and there isn't enough light shining on the social and systemic and structural issues that shape why people engage in these conversations in the first place. And there isn't enough consideration around the way in which these platforms are developed that may also enable these behaviors as well.
Help us connect some dots here. How could gangs, how a person wrapped up in a gang, how might they be using their social media?
So here's the thing. I think it's not really helpful to focus on individuals that may be associated with gangs. We see these behaviors consistently throughout a diverse population. I think what's different is context, right? And so it is not uncommon from all walks of life for us to see aggressive and threatening communication on social media. I think that we can all identify a few really key examples in our life. I think what's different in the communities that I work in is that when those conversations are had, there is a ecology of violence that also informs how people need to respond offline. And in part, that response can take different pathways because of one's susceptibility to violence offline. And so, again, I think understanding the context around the conversations, around the language, is probably the most important piece here.
Yeah. So what happens when there is a conversation on social media? How does that then translate to the brick and mortar of the real world with relationships and people face to face?
You know, what's really challenging is the visibility and virality of social media. And so conversations that were typically had, 20 years ago probably could have been de-escalated or resolved because it would take longer for the content to disseminate through a network. Now, what you say, what you do has direct impact. It moves really quickly, can be screenshot and saved and sent through the masses in your network and in networks that you're not a part of as well. So this is a part of the kind of process or the pathway by which what you say can lead to trouble offline.
We're talking with Desmond Patton. He is an associate professor of social work at Columbia University in New York, and he's founding director of Safe Lab. It's a research initiative at Columbia focused on examining the ways in which youth of color navigate violence on and offline. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are some posts that you have seen on social media that you think are threatening, or have you been threatened on social media? What are those posts like? Are there specific languages that go on in your neighborhood with your friends? Join in at 800-642-1234. Desmond, how do we accurately understand the language, the context, the culture, when there are so few words on social media that those words may hold a lot of weight and have a lot more meaning than we may think they do?
Well, first, I think it's important to take a step back and to ask ourselves, why do we want to understand the context and how are we using that context? And so if we're using the context to support people, to get them resources and to create an environment where they can thrive, then I think it's important that we understand the language that's being used. For example, oftentimes rap lyrics are misinterpreted or misconstrued as being aggression. Even in our own algorithmic systems, what we found is that oftentimes the use of the N-word would be identified as being aggressive as opposed to understanding the deeper meaning. And what happens is that when those types of posts are misinterpreted, they can be used as evidence in the legal system. And it's missing key environmental and cultural understanding that may paint a different picture. And so again, I just want to reiterate this point that we need to really first think about the questions that we're asking of social media data, that we're asking of artificial intelligence before deploying it in any kind of social environment.
What are some examples, perhaps, of emojis and symbols that you now interpret to be an actual threat? What is the impact of emojis?
So I think that emojis are important, but once again, I think that there isn't one emoji that makes the difference. It's got to we have to have a contextual understanding here. So, for example, in my lab, we have understood that the devil face emoji in some instances may be an indicator of aggression. But when we look at that and generalize it to a larger population, it had a very different connotation, very different meaning. So I think that we have to make sure that we are looking at emoji and languages within the intended audience context before deciphering or making any kind of broader generalizable meaning around them.
Let's bring in Eric and Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I had more of a comment. I just wanted to say this social media tool to algorithmically track patterns of violence and grief and loss is different. But personally, I think that this is going to be utilized by the government as a monitoring tool. Creator said it's not intended to be, but I don't see how this technology couldn't be used like that. And I personally don't want to live in a type of world like that.
Eric, thanks so much for the call. And we're going to get you an answer from Desmond Patton in just a moment. He's an associate professor of social work at Columbia University, founding director of Safe Lab. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. What are the posts that you see on social media in your own neighborhood, in your own community? How do you communicate? Are you a member of law enforcement? Do you deal with people on social media? Does your department use social media to track behavior or other violence? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about social media posts and what they tell us about violence. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. A lab at Columbia is finding that young people post expressions of trauma and grief or stress before ratcheting up, before turning to more aggressive or threatening posts. So do you think law enforcement should look at social media to help prevent violence? Have you ever been threatened on social media? We're at 800-642-1234. Desmond Patton is an associate professor of social work and sociology at Columbia, and he founded the Safe Lab there. Desmond, going back to Eric and Madison, who called in and says this could be a real slippery slope with law enforcement. How might police use social media data?
Well, here's the thing. I actually really agree with Eric. I think his point is well taken. And I think the challenge is that it can be misused. What the reality is that we already live in a surveillance state. So our social media, our communication, our conversations are already monitored. We have seen this in New York City. We've seen it in Chicago. And so I think that it's something that should already be on our radar. I think within our lab, what we have changed our direction, what we've understood by privileging the voices of young Black and brown young people is that they're actually using this space to get support and to get help, and that we can be a part of helping them get those resources before things become more challenging. But with regard to law enforcement, I think that we really need to think critically about the use of these tools for as evidence in the legal system. I think what we've learned is that understanding the context is extremely hard. So when we first started out, we started to use the gold standard artificial intelligence systems, and none of them worked on identifying and understanding the language from the communities that we were working in. It failed every single time. However, when we began to include young people in our process, when they became the central focus point, the systems were better at identifying loss and trauma and aggression, but we still have errors, there is still bias that we need to consider. And what I'm concerned is with the false positives and the false negatives. When we get things wrong, what happens? And when we think we get things right, what happens? And so I think that we really need to stop and think about the extent to which these approaches, the use of social media, the use of artificial intelligence can lead to a new e-carceral state.
Implicit biases through these tools, through artificial intelligence, having biases embedded in them?
So oftentimes we focus on the tools, and I really think we need to focus on the people. We are developing the tools. We are putting in our biases into the creation of these tools. So first, we need to think about a racial literacy that is important to developing these tools. So Matale Nkande at Harvard Berkman Klein Center has been working to develop a set of racial literacy tools for really helping us to think about the questions that we should ask of AI before deploying it in any social system.
Let's bring in Dick now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Dick.
Oh, good morning. And I have to say, you know, first, I'm a judge. And one of the things I sometimes deal with young people who are in difficulty. And one of the things that strikes me is that sometimes we look at this in respect to the last caller as only a criminal justice matter, and it's not necessarily that. We have to look sometimes at early interventions through the mental health and other systems as well. And in that context, how can we use, as people in the community, parents, adults, people in responsible positions, use this type of information to look at something and say, look, you know, here's a kid who may need some help, and, you know, let's get to him before he becomes a statistic. And I think, you know, that's a huge problem. But how do we keep somebody from, we're trying to prevent people from entering the criminal justice system when we're dealing with juveniles.
Dick, thank you so much for those observations. Desmond?
I completely agree, and that's a really important point. And I think that one of the things we need to do is just raise some awareness around what people are saying and doing on social media, and to understand that the language may say more than what we think. And so oftentimes in the data that we're looking at, young people are crying out, I need help, I'm struggling, I feel pain, I feel trauma, and it just sits on the platform, and it sits, and it sits, and it goes nowhere until someone else sees it and either retweets it, reshares it, screenshots it, and then it takes a different pathway in a different direction. I think there's an opportunity to harness some of these call-outs to adults, to support networks, and to be able to connect young people with resources. And so we could then, you know, take a post and then wire that post to a set of social workers or to a school counselor or to a church or to a hospital so that people can get the type of support that they need when they are leveraging these tools to do so. But again, I think we've had a missed opportunity because we have only focused on a very punitive lens and on a criminal justice perspective. And what I'm trying to kind of articulate to a lot of folks from a social work perspective is that there's so much that can be done before those posts actually are problematic in the first place.
Yeah. Do you think we're behind from a social work perspective because we have the 800 numbers, we have various places in our communities where you can walk in the door to receive help, but are we lagging on the social media front?
Well, here's the thing. A lot of people do not have access to these resources in their community. They can't just walk in the door. They don't have the means or the support to do so. But social media is a purely unadulterated space where we can present possible selves and multiple selves and to be vulnerable, hyper-vulnerable in these spaces. And so I think that we really need to think about social media is a new ecological environment where behavior happens, and we need social workers and mental health practitioners that are in this new ecological environment to help support people as well.
You have this history of hiring researchers, troubled young people from Chicago. How have they perhaps redefined where you go with your research? Have you seen your own work in a different light?
100%. We have taken a completely different direction. I think that one of the things that we did wrong in the beginning is that we were imbibing these stories about young black and brown young people and assuming that the way in which they would use social media would be negative. Then when we dug deeper, we started to read these stories, understand these narratives, and hire young people, we realized that we were looking at the wrong thing and that we weren't humanizing these folks. And I think that that was a course direction that was forced by listening to young people, hearing them, trusting them, and believing them. And now we are focused on understanding their life from their experiences, from their mouths. And so now the direction that we go is led by what the young people tell us and not what we think we should be doing in this space.
When you have conversations with young people and you've seen troubling posts, as a social worker, where do you start those conversations? What do they look like? Because many of these youth are living on social media. So much of their life is online.
You know, it's about meeting people where they are. And it becomes a really interesting kind of dynamic when a young person knows that you understand their social media space. And so we have been spending time with young people in Brooklyn, and it just opened up a new way of engagement in which they can then bring in stories that are happening at school, in the family, and in the community vis-a-vis their communication on social media in a way that may not happen when they're talking to a teacher one-on-one or talking to a social worker. It becomes a talking point that they're excited about, that they're engaged with, and that they want to explore more. And so I think bringing in social media into conversations with young people and allowing them to share what's happening, what's being posted, what's being shared is a great entry point to having hopefully more open conversations that can prevent future more problematic conversations down the line. And what I really hope is that we really begin to help young people think about a more informed way of being online, not a good or bad binary, but what does it mean to be a digital citizen? What does it mean to be a part of this new environment, this new world that you live on? And how do we help young people make the most informed decision about how they show up in digital spaces?
Desmond, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Desmond Patton is an associate professor of social work at Columbia University in New York, and he's founding director of Safe Lab. It's a research initiative at Columbia focused on looking at the ways in which youth of color navigate on and offline. Just ahead, we take a closer look at why thousands of donated kidneys are thrown away each year in the U.S. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.